So you guys are in Missouri, right?
Yep, St. Louis.
Did you watch the game?
I don't really sport ball. What kind of
Oh,
game?
come on. The Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift. They've been making national headlines. The Kansas City Chiefs.
Football.
Yeah.
No, yeah, no,
No.
I don't really, I don't engage in sport ball. I don't have time for that nonsense.
It's been all over the news.
What happened? Keep me like update me so that I.
Travis Kelce's a player for the Kansas City Chiefs, and he I guess Taylor Swift played at their stadium, and he kind of made a an offer, like, hey, let's go on a date or whatever. And I guess she took him up on the offer, and she surprised at the stadium. And
Really?
it's kind of like, I don't know, it's like it's, sort of symbolic of when Tom Brady was with Giselle. You know what I mean? It's kind of like the circle of Hollywood and sports coming together again. And I don't know,
All
it's all over the
right.
news,
Okay.
I
I've never
guess.
heard of most of those people. I've heard of Taylor Swift.
You must have heard of Taylor Swift. She's an
The other
icon
ones,
right
not so
now.
much. All right. Hey, Katrina, I've not met you yet. You want to tell us? You want to say hi?
Hi.
Whoops, no. Unmute. All right, tell us where you live and I don't know, whatever you think is interesting.
Much, I believe.
You're where?
If we have met you
Oh,
before,
okay.
I just I don't know. You say something too. Yeah, you say
Well, my
something.
name is Nancy, Katrina's mother, and we also live in Missouri. And
Yes.
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 Where in Missouri?
Arnold,
Farmington?
Arnold,
Oh,
Arnold.
Arnold. Oh, that's super close to me.
Yes, I'm in Peavely, actually.
She's in Peavely. I'm in Arnold.
Oh, I've spent many a night in Peavely at the Girl Scout camp.
Oh yes, me too.
Years and
I was
years.
a Girl Scout, so
Nice.
I spent the night there with her, but ended up sleeping, me and another lady ended up sleeping in her car because of the huge roach problem there.
It's outside. Sometimes
Yeah,
there are bugs there.
it was outside. It was like, no, we will just sleep in the car. But
Oh, hang on.
it
I
was
gotta
fun.
make sure I can find my there we go.
I do want to ask you a question since I'm
Yeah,
on.
ask me a question. Yeah,
I had
please.
someone from NARSL call me. Is that normal? Some guy from, like, he's the head of NARSL called me at 9 p.m. the other night about joining that.
That seems like a very weird
I'm
thing to
thinking
do
the same.
with
Yeah,
anyone on the registry.
yes, he.
I would not necessarily trust that. That's a very
I
weird,
just. I,
it's a
it
very
was,
weird way to reach out,
yeah, it was.
especially to our population, because our population is especially
Not this
untrusting of
one.
the world because people take advantage of us so much.
Yeah,
So,
right. I was just, it was very weird. And my boyfriend goes, "What's going on?" I said, "I have no idea." I said, but he had my email and everything and said they're having a meeting on the 2nd and of
huh.
October. And I'm
Yeah, I
like,
mean,
okay. And I said, I'm still going to go to war or go to war. That doesn't sound, I'm still going to do the meetings. And he goes, well, you don't need to do that. And I'm like, well, I want to. So
what was he telling you not to come to this meeting for? We're all on the
don't
same page.
know. I know that's what I'm saying.
We're all fighting the
He said
same
they
fight.
connect together, but he's like, well, you can go to one or the other or do both. Or I said, well, I'd like to do both because this is for my son. I'd like to get as much information as possible, to
Yeah,
help.
absolutely. Oh, and tonight's speaker is it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, feel free to communicate with me outside this if you want to send me an email at ann@warfamilyfoundation.org.
Okay.
I would be happy to follow up with you about this later.
Okay,
Eric,
that's, thank you.
do you agree that that's a weird way for a person to reach out to a random stranger?
Sorry, I just heard the very last of what Katrina said. So,
Katrina, repeat what you just said and see if Eric
yeah,
does any, because I think he
that's
knows more about
actually
it.
who called me.
That's
That's actually who called me, so I'm good.
Oh, it was Eric that called
Yeah.
you. Oh, okay. Well,
I
I
mean,
met Eric. I don't know why Eric called me.
that was you. Yeah. Okay. I'm good then.
Oh, okay.
I
Well,
don't get many people call me late at night, so you know.
I had a list to go through. Okay, now I got to
Nice to meet you.
see
So,
your glasses. You look sketchy.
Oh yeah, well, I'm a mess, okay?
I don't think you can eat
And
that.
I go through this at work too. I'm always half up and half down. I'm short, so it's, you know. I
Ah.
have gone to great lengths that I'm in the middle of my frame. I have a pillow underneath my chair because I can't figure out how to raise it any higher. And I put my whole computer monitor up on a tall thing like this tall so that it'll be the right height. Not really so that you guys have a view of my painting, but mostly because otherwise I'm looking down all day and then my neck hurts because too old to look down all day. I like to look straight ahead because it's more ergonomic. All right, let's see. Who haven't I met yet? Have we met? I don't think I've ever read the name, heard the name Tiffany Minkle. Tiffany Minkle, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm in Minnesota. I have a brother that's been civilly committed for 18 years, so just kind of jumping on.
Oh, I'm sorry. Minnesota's really awful for that.
Yeah, I know.
When at the NARFL conference in June, one of the talks was all about civil commitment. And during the talk, they actually had a guy on the phone from a civil commitment facility. And then another group had big fat like writings of another guy in a civil commitment facility in Minnesota. And yeah, that was just one of the many things that felt like drinking water from a fire hose that weekend. Yikes. Yeah, the things we do to each other, and especially today after reading this book, the whole book is just one just terrible, terrible story after another. So I'm sorry, that's awful. How do you follow that up? I guess you just call in another person. How about have we heard from Mickey ever? Mickey, are you there?
Matt, how do you unmute this?
I unmuted you.
Oh, you did. Oh, can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Mickey.
Hi, this is my first time at one of the meetings, but I was very interested in this meeting and I wanted to join to see what's going on.
Are you the, you're not the Mickey from the book, are you?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Did I talked to somebody when I read that story. It reminded me a lot of a woman that I had talked to on the 1-800 number. Have I talked to you on the 1-800 number before?
I think maybe, yes,
Are you
maybe.
the one who lives in New York and your neighbors
Yes.
harass your son all the time?
Yes,
Ah.
that was me. Yes.
I can tell that that story was you because I think when we had our phone call, I think you said she interviewed me for the book. So when
Yes.
I read that story, I didn't remember your name, but the story sounded so familiar that
Yeah,
I.
that was me. I haven't read the book yet.
Oh, you
Yeah,
should definitely read the book.
I'm dying to read the book.
It is one hell of a book. Look at
Yeah.
all these post-it notes I took.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's we got 3 more minutes, but in 3 more minutes, I'm going to read you one of the reviews on the back cover that is just I thought spot on. Wish the Emily's here. Right, I think we have time to call on maybe one or two more people. So let's see. Have I ever talked to Virginia? You want to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm from Daytona Beach. You have met me
I
before.
have met you. Okay, sorry.
No,
Well, that's all right. Let's
that's
see. Who haven't I met? Have I ever met Amy? I have a terrible memory.
No, actually, this is my first time here. I have a son, and actually very he's still coming up on sentencing, so yeah, this is very
Heart,
new for
heart.
me.
I'm sorry you got sucked into this really terrible system.
Me
So,
too. I'm in Virginia. I don't know if that matters.
it matters to the people from Virginia. Yeah, it's so Massachusetts Mike and anybody else who couldn't afford the $60 book. What I did was I also borrowed it from Joanne, but I requested it from my library because my library apparently, if you request a book, they figure if somebody asks for it, there's probably other people that want it too, and they just order it. And then you're the first in line when you get it. So I don't know if your library does that, but it's worth asking because that way, the book gets a sale and you with, limited resources don't have to pay for it. It's great. And then other people get to read it and then it's in the library so that maybe, maybe if you're lucky, other people will, read the book. Okay, 6:59. One more. Did I call on Tiffany Minkleton? Oh, Maureen. I've never heard of Maureen, I don't think. Want to say hi?
Nope. I have followed along a lot, but I've never joined one of these, so I'm looking forward to participating. I'm in
Nice.
Virginia also.
All right. That's cool. Okay. It is now officially 7 p.m. and I have gotten harassed before for not starting the meeting on time. So I'm going to start the meeting on time. All right. So the quote on the back of the book, which I thought was just spot on. Oh, first I will introduce, our guest. I can find my. Okay. Hello, everybody. I would like to introduce you to Emily Horowitz. A lot of you probably already know her. She's the professor and chair of sociology and criminal justice at St. Francis College in Brooklyn, where she founded and co-directs the post-prison program, which is a nationally recognized program that helps formerly incarcerated students earn college degrees. She's the author of Protecting Our Kids, How Sex Offender Laws Are Failing Us, and her new book, From Rage to Reason, Why We Need Sex Crime Laws Based on Facts, Not Fear. That's the one we're reading tonight. It just came out in May. Emily has conducted research on sex offense law and policy for over two decades and works with organizations that challenge public conviction registries and banishment laws. She holds a PhD in sociology from Yale. And this is the review of the book, which I thought was just absolutely spot on. This may be the bravest book you have ever read. Horowitz's meticulous interviews with people on sex offender registries returns a modicum of humanity, not just to them, but more importantly, to the rest of us. As she aptly describes, registries are utterly useless for preventing new sex crimes. All they do is sentence to social and civil death people who have already served their time of punishment and labored to repent. We can ill afford to deny rights and humanity to anyone in our culture. To do so cuts us all at an Achilles heel that very few of us are willing to acknowledge. Horowitz won't let us look away. That's pretty much what the book felt like to me. Felt like Clockwork Orange. And as hard as it was to read, I think we need to all read it. Anyway, take it away, Emily Horowitz. Oops, hang on, I gotta unmute you.
Okay, thank you. May I share my screen?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm gonna enable you. Whoops, no, that's not what I'm doing.
Yeah, you do have permission already.
Oh, thank you, Chuck. Okay. All right, just share my screen. Okay, all right, let me just, can everyone see my screen? Just
I can see most, oh, there we go. Now I can see it.
Okay. All right. So thank you so much, Anne and War, for having me tonight. I really appreciate this opportunity to share my book and some of my findings. I assume everyone here is directly impacted in some way by the registry. So I'm speaking to a group of people who mostly know what I found in my book. So I'm going to briefly share with you the results of my interviews and what I attempted to do in this book. And then I would love to hear your thoughts and have a discussion about ways maybe I could get people outside of this community to read this book and whether you think this book is a good way to humanize and help people better understand the plight and realities of these terrible, cruel, useless laws. Okay. I wrote a book that was published in 2015 about the registry. And since that time, I've engaged in activism and some advocacy. I've done some public speaking, some public debates. But it's clear to me, it became clear to me, particularly during COVID, that our approach to and attitude about those on registries is actually getting worse. And I think I've said this many times, if you ever heard me before, but the trajectory of a social movement should be that sociologists and others raise concerns, highlight injustices, and then things get better. So it was troubling to me that when my book came out in 2015, things seemed like somewhat more promising and to be getting better. And there was a few things that happened, including the Me Too movement, the growth of QAnon, and a lot of paranoia and rhetoric about groomers and things like that on the right that made me very frightened about this community and about this issue and made me want to write another book. So I wrote a proposal and my publisher was interested in another book. They were convinced that my questions, like, are things getting worse for people on registries? Also, in spite of a lot of real criminal legal reform efforts that were very successful regarding legalization of drugs and decreasing our prison population and the popularity of books about mass incarceration and equating mass incarceration with racism became very popular as a talking point on the right and the left. And there became a lot of movement on transforming our system of mass incarceration. But those unregistries were really left behind. And not only were they left behind, in my view, they became further villainized. So my research questions were like, why are people on registries excluded from reform efforts? And why are attitudes towards those on registries and about sex crimes and sexual offenses, why is it going backwards? Why is it growing worse? Which is not how things generally happen when there are social movement organizations and awareness. So the methods that I used, I'm a sociologist. I did in-depth interviews with people on registries. I think the interviews I did for this book were much better than the interviews I did in 2013, 2014 for my last book, because number one, I think people trusted me a bit more. I had a book that had already come out. I've done a lot of public speaking and advocacy. So I feel like people that I spoke to already knew that I wasn't just some anonymous researcher. I also think partly because of COVID, I was able to do like 2-3 hour Zoom interviews with many, many people where people really opened up and shared with me what it was really like to be on the registry. So my research questions, my methods, those are very clear. My hypotheses were not as clear. Like I wasn't really sure what I thought. I thought that maybe things were getting worse because both the left and the right had heightened panics about issues related to sex and sexual offenses for very different reasons. On the right, I keep saying QAnon and Pizzagate, but on the right, ideas about sex rings and groomers and things like that were really exploding. And a lot of people, even to this day, think that there are a group of elite Democrats who sexually harm children, and it's like a plot, and it's kind of unbelievable. And when I wrote my first book, this wasn't really a thing. And then on the left, you saw the growth of the Me Too movement, which was really like sexual harassment is everywhere in spite of feminism, in spite of everything. It's pervasive. You also saw a lot of panic about campus rape and things like that. And so both of those things. So my hypothesis was that we grew further isolated. We didn't have any allies on the left or the right. Okay. So what I found during these conversations will not be a surprise to any of you. Each of the chapters in my book, as Anne said, it's a very hard book to read, which is why I am a bit concerned about people outside our community reading it. When I look at it now, it's a really hard book to read because each chapter is basically interviews with people about what it's like to live as an outcast, to live in a state of banishment, to live in a state of essentially civil death or civic death, as some say. So I divided these impacts into 7 areas. 3 are related to the legal impacts, and then 4 related to the emotional and psychological impacts. So I'll just go through a few of those. I'm glad Mickey is here. Mickey, you're one of the only, your story is featured in this book. If you're comfortable saying a few words about that, that would be wonderful. Yes. So I'll tell you some of the impacts that I found. Employment, we know that across the board, if you have a criminal conviction, employment is a challenge. In recent years, many states have passed laws making it illegal to discriminate on the basis of criminal history. Although many states, including really progressive states like California, that have really good protections for people with criminal histories, do discriminate against those who are on registries. They don't do it directly, but you're allowed to say things like, well, this job involves contact with children, or you're alone with customers, things like that, and it's a threat. So while there's been a lot of movement encouraging employment for those with criminal legal histories, it hasn't really impacted those on registries. In addition, those on registries have really unique employment challenges because others with criminal histories, they're not on a public list. So even if human resources knows that they have a criminal history, the other employees don't have it. Colleagues and customers Many people reported to me that they would find out about the registry and then they would be fired. People would often say my boss is okay with it, but he's frightened of customers and colleagues. A theme that emerged that was unlike, there's a lot of literature on the impact of a criminal conviction on employment. But one thing that emerged through my interviews, which I don't think I would have found otherwise, is that those on registries who do obtain employment are mistreated by employers, colleagues, and coworkers. They're afraid to complain. They're afraid to report being bullied or mistreated. They're afraid to be promoted because they don't want to be in a position of having to fire someone and make enemies. So I heard many stories of people who were employed, but were treated very badly and were very, you know, unwilling to quit because they knew finding a new job would be so challenging. So many people said, like, this is a dead end job. You know, I never get a raise. I could do so much more, but I stay out of fear. Housing challenges, very obvious. People are afraid to move. People are afraid that a new law will be enacted and they'll have to move. I interviewed a couple of people who are on private registries. So many people said to me, like, I know private registries aren't great, but, you know, they're, and obviously they are better than public registries, but even people on private registries have significant housing challenges because, of course, when you do a background check, you find out the person has a sexual offense, and landlord fear renting to people who have a sexual offense, even if it's not public listed. Here in New York, many people are level ones on the registry, and I've talked to many of them, and they have significant issues finding landlords willing to rent to them, even though they're not publicly listed. Sellers and agents are unwilling to sell to those on registries. Many people reported to me, even if they were able to find a house, there were many issues with banks and obtaining mortgages, which is something I'm studying now. It's very confusing, but some banks and other lenders don't want to lend money to people on registries, even if they are financially qualified. So that's another burden to housing. And obviously, residency restrictions in general are a major cause of homelessness. You look at places like Chicago and Florida, where there's many, many people who have family who would house them, who can afford housing, and are homeless simply because of restrictions. So in terms of housing, obviously residency restrictions are a huge problem. But even without registry restrictions, in places like New York, and even not being on a public registry, housing is a huge problem if you have a prior sexual offense conviction. Travel restrictions. The only group subject to restrictions on domestic travel post-supervision are those on registries. I feel like it's something that doesn't get a lot of attention either in the literature, even within social movement organizations, but it's insane if you really think about it. Nobody knows about it unless you're on the registry, really. And obviously they're the only group subject to a passport stamp, but there are, you know, people with other forms of criminal convictions aren't allowed to enter certain countries, but they don't have a stamp. But the restrictions on domestic travel, which I hadn't really thought about, are profound. If you have family, if you have work obligations, many, many people told me that they had challenges traveling to fulfill professional obligations. Sorry, I see a 9 got in there when I was uploading it. I'm sorry. Anyway, traveling is a huge problem. And again, it's one of those things that doesn't seem like the worst thing. There's many other priorities, but it's not just the impact on employment. It's just an impact on your psyche and your life when you can't just go to another state for a few days, when you can't just go to another country, things most of us take for granted, especially those who have family in other countries. That's very painful that they cannot visit them. So proximity laws, a lot of states don't have proximity laws, but many do. I think about over 20 do now, and those are laws that relate to presence, where you can be, how far you can be from certain places. And these are really problematic for those who live in these states. many people were very upset because they couldn't attend religious services because the proximity laws prevent them from being in places where there's childcare centers. things like not being able to hike in parks, attending family reunions, the inability to even attend funerals or celebrations. One man I interviewed was, his father was very, very ill, and he was involved in a very elaborate negotiation with his with the registry office to figure out if he could attend his father's funeral when it would happen. And many, many people can't pick up their kids, can't attend school events, can't attend sporting events, can't attend graduations. And that's very, very painful. And that obviously also affects children and families. Sorry. Okay. so those are all like legal and civil regulations that impact the lives of those on registries. But the psychological effect of being on a registry or having a sexual offense conviction, because it's not just the registry and it's not just the laws, creates a situation where a few people use this term. They said it's like, I'm alive, but I'm not alive. After their conviction, friends and families disappear. Even family members are shunned. Many people said, well, my mother kept talking to me, so now they don't talk to my mother. My sister stopped talking to me, so the rest of the family is, you know, comfortable with her. So many people who had been good fathers, good sons, good friends are banished. And friends who remain are often questioned, and they wind up leaving just because of the stress of having people say, how can you be friends with someone who did that? Obviously, wives and partners often leave. Many people who are convicted of sexual offenses are young, as we know. And I don't even mean minors, but 18 to 25 people who aren't in, they're not married yet. So after their conviction, they're single. Dating is difficult, to put it mildly. And it's not just the restrictions on dating apps, but obviously meeting people and sharing with them that you are on a registry and everything that comes with that. Sorry. Something else that happens to those on the registry that, again, isn't related to the legal impact of the regulations is banishment and harassment. People are banished and harassed. Mickey, if you want to share maybe during the Q&A what's happened to you, what happened to you is very extreme, but it's not that unusual. Unfortunately, people just harassed and tormented by community members, by anybody. People are driven out of neighborhoods, driven out of communities, driven out of churches, driven out of things like community-based organizations, like people who worked, you know, with volunteering with animals or doing other things. When word gets out that they're on the registry, they're asked to leave. Many people were asked to leave things like yoga centers. They go to a yoga center and it would be their community. Somebody would find out they were on the registry and they'd be asked to leave. And I always like the example of yoga centers because that's a community where, you know, forgiveness and restorative justice and everything is very important. Church is a little bit different, but, you know, people being asked to leave communities like that, that would otherwise be very understanding of mistakes and human error. I'm right now also very interested in the subject of scams, which came up over and over again, and there's really no peer-reviewed research on that subject. But people on registries, as I'm sure many people on the call know, are subject to scams all the time. And one of the reasons why many people on registries fall for these scams is that, one, they're very traumatized from the experience of being convicted of a sexual offense. So they fear authority. So when someone calls, when I say scams, I mean, somebody calls and says, hi, I'm from parole. You didn't pay this fine. And if you don't bring me cash right now or give me the numbers on a gift card, I'm going to report you and you're going to go back to prison. Or you missed this date, or why didn't you register this car? And it sounds absurd, but because all of people's entire conviction history is on the internet, people are often tricked because the person calling and posing as law enforcement has a lot of information, right? If you live in Texas, even your shoe size is on there. So they know lots of information about you. They know where you work, and they're able to perpetrate these scams. Again, they're also targeting like a population that is super traumatized. Another thing is that police don't protect those on registries. if you call the police because you're subject to harassment, if you, even if you're robbed, anything like that, I heard story after story of law enforcement not treating people on registries the same way they would treat anybody else. So they're not that interested in scams. One guy said, I thought, you know, it was a huge problem if you pretend to be a law enforcement officer and somebody's calling me and my mom pretending to be a law enforcement officer. And they just said, you know, don't worry about it. I get tricked too. I get scam phone calls too. Why? No big deal. Just hang up, you know. Other people reported really extreme forms of harassment, having eggs thrown at their door, and they would have like ring doorbells and tape, you know, they'd have recordings and the police would really shrug their shoulders and say, well, what do you want? What do you want? So part of it, part of the banishment, it's feeling like even the law doesn't protect you. You're so dehumanized that law enforcement doesn't recognize you as the same as everyone else. Finally, there's so much collateral damage. Children of those on registries are shamed. They're harmed. They lose contact with parents very frequently. Wives and partners suffer because they too are subject to the public shaming of having their home listed on the registry. And parents of those on registries also really suffer because as a result of their conviction, many adult children move home and have to spend, have to rely on their parents in ways that they wouldn't have to if they hadn't had this conviction. So parents also really, really suffer. I know War Women Against the Registry was largely founded to kind of highlight the impact of registries on mothers and children and others, women and children who these laws are supposed to protect. One study found, I think that, sorry, I want to say 60% of people on registries have children, and that's a huge number of people who are harmed and shamed, and they're harmed in direct ways, having their homes listed on the registry. They're harmed because their friends can find out really easily that they have a parent on the registry, and then they're harmed indirectly because their parents can't make a living or support them, or obviously in custody, it's in custody battles. Being on the registry makes it very difficult. So there's a lot of collateral damage. So finally, I'm going to conclude here. I'm going to open the chat and we can have a conversation. But my last chapter is called Worse Than Murder, because one thing that people on registries always say, I'm treated worse than somebody who's murdered. And one thing that I also hear when I talk about my work with people who are not part of this community, who are not sympathetic to this cause, is that they'll say, well, I do think a sexual crime is worse than murder. I don't really want to know if my neighbor committed a sexual offense. I mean, committed a murder, but I do want to know if they committed a sexual offense. And having taught this and done a lot of public speaking and somebody who gets a lot of emails from the general public, people will really argue that it's worse than murder, this crime, and therefore all of these restrictions are completely justified. So I think really my work at this time is to work more with social movement organizations and figure out ways to get rid of these laws. I hope that my book convinces some people or raises awareness about the harm of these laws. In particular, we know that these laws have been upheld on the grounds that they're not punishment. So my grandiose fantasy about this book is that anybody who reads this book will see this is punishment. This is the worst punishment. There's no way you can read these stories and not understand that this is punishment. This is punishment on steroids. So my grandiose fantasy is that somebody will get this before a court and they'll say, you know, this isn't punishment. And somebody will read it and finally say, yes, this is punishment. I deliberately didn't do any new quantitative research, although, of course, I cite all the important studies. I think there is a huge amount of extraordinarily compelling peer-reviewed research that shows that none of these laws make any of us safer. They fly in the face of all evidence about keeping us safer and creating barriers to employment, to housing, to happiness. Those are all things that create the conditions for recidivism. So they're just stupid, cruel, and useless. And I hope that this was useful to you. And I hope that we can think together about what the goals of social movement organizations that are fighting to abolish the registry, what should they be? I think we all have to think about that. There's been a lot of organizations for many years and things are getting worse in many ways. So I think really thinking about what we can do, particularly this last point, joining with other organizations working on criminal legal reform is really the key to showing that people who commit sexual offenses are no different than anyone else who made a mistake. They don't need special regulations. They're driven by all of the same causes of any other criminal offense. And therefore, we should not be excluded from those organizations or those efforts. Thank you so much. Anne, we can have a conversation.
All right. First, I'm going to just tell you how this goes in case you're new, because a bunch of you are new. If you go down to the bottom of your screen, you'll see a box called Reactions. And in that reactions box, there's a way to raise hand. So if you have a question for Emily that you want to pose, you can raise your hand and I'll try to, you know, call on you and make this all run smoothly. Saying that made me forget my first question or my first comment. Oh, yeah, you were talking about partnering with other organizations. And one of the things that we've been kind of discussing in our sort of our 6-month revamp has been, you know, things to do moving forward. And that's one of the big ones that we think is really important. In so many situations, you know, there are other organizations working on reentry programs. They're working on Medicaid for guys coming out of prison. They're working on, you know, ban the box. They're working on voting rights reform. They're working on all these different topics. And we're so busy just trying to stay alive and not get, you know, vigilante killed and, you know, figure out where to stay. And they've made our lives so complicated that just figuring out what the rules are in a state, figuring out, because they're intentionally complicated. And I just see so many parallels between the things that they do to our guys and like Jim Crow, you know, when they first, they said, okay, fine, we have to give you all you people, all you Black people, the right to vote. But, you know, they're going to have a whole bunch of things that you have to do first. And they're not going to post it on the website and say, okay, you need to bring, you know, your real ID and you're this and you're this or this. No, you'd show up to vote and they'd say, oh, well, you know, do you know the capital of Tennessee? And, you know, do you have property? And they would just change the rules every time. Well, you know, the registration scheme does exactly that. You know, you think you've read all the rules and you think you're very carefully trying to follow the rules. This just happened to us, my partner and I, like last month. We were traveling. He was going to fly to St. Louis, spend the night, and then drive to Michigan in the morning where his parents live. And the registry office was closed by the time his flight arrived because his flight didn't get until like 8:30. We were leaving the next day. So he had filled out all the paperwork. He told all the states we were driving through, Illinois, India, you know, everybody, we were coming. Well, we're halfway to Michigan and he gets a call from the St. Louis asshole, you know, mad at him because he had misread the rules. The rules said you could be in the state 7 total calendar days before you had to, you know, go tell them, you know, one at a time. Well, he figured, well, that was my first day. And he had tried. He actually flew home just to register on his birthday because he figured he'd like to just stay registered in Missouri so that he doesn't have to go down to the office every time he comes to visit me because, you know, he's still my partner. He still comes here all the time. And they said, no, you can't do that. You can't register in 2 states. So just, you know, see ya, sayonara, have fun in Kansas. Well, the thing said you have 7 days. So he thought, well, this is day 1 of the 7. Well, no, they actually went back to January and said, no, you've used all your days on January 7th, even though in January he was still registered in Missouri. He hadn't even moved yet. So it's like they cannot deny that they're intentionally making these rules specifically to make them impossible to follow. And the number of stories in your book where people had violations for just complete nonsense, like the guy who tried to commit suicide, his parole officer knew he was in a psychiatric facility because he'd tried to commit suicide. Because of that, he missed his little bullshit therapy meeting and they violated him and sent him back to prison. Yeah, you've got to be kidding me. But nobody knows but us and nobody cares about us. And we're so busy, you know, they keep us so busy, you know, juggling all the hoops of, you know, travel and employment and relationships and, housing, they keep us so busy with all that that we don't have the resources, we don't have the time, we don't have the emotional bandwidth to push back. And if we tried, they'd say, you know, suck it up. Oh, they're trying to scam you. You know, big deal. Yeah, it's terrifying.
I don't know that that was a question, but that was a really...
Sorry. I was just saying, yes, we need to partner with other people, with other organizations. Oh yeah, that's where I was going. That what we are starting to believe we need to do is, instead of just advocating for our issue, because no one's really ready to hear our issue, that what we should do is we should start sitting on and working with the groups that are, you know, working on prison reform, and they're working on Medicaid for All. And so we, as an organization, have started to join those kinds of working groups. I was on a working group about civil commitment in New York. We've been on calls about Medicaid for people getting out of prison. And we're hopeful that if we all start to, you know, be more visible, we got to do a lot of things. I mean, it's an uphill battle, but one of the things that I think we need to do is we need to start showing up for these other causes so that at the last minute, they don't carve us out, you know, because when we're the person who's been coming there, you know, month after month, working on Medicaid or working on voting rights restoration or whatever we've been working on, we're hoping that because we're now a human being, it's a little harder for them to throw us under the bus at the last minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. No hands up. Oh, there's a hand. Eric, hit us with some insights.
Thanks for coming, Dr. Horowitz. Appreciate it. You know, I was looking at this book, and for those of us that have been incarcerated, the garb that they're wearing, the boots, the bleachers are all very recognizable. Is there a backstory to this cover right here?
Yeah, there is. Thanks for asking that. Somebody on the registry who used to be an art professor, I interviewed him for my book. And then when I was looking for cover art, I reached out to him and he drew this and donated it to, it's online, and I have a slide that I'll put up with a discount code if you haven't bought it yet, because the publisher gave me a discount code when I do these events. In any case, he was incarcerated, and while he was incarcerated, he's a very talented artist. He did a lot of drawings, and this was supposed to be of men who are in prison on bleachers watching, just doing nothing and bored. But I really liked it because they were kind of like on the outside and on the inside. A lot of people said, like, I feel like I'm alive, but I'm not alive. I'm human, but I'm not human. I'm part of the world, but I'm not part of the world. Like, I heard that over and over and over. And I felt like this picture kind of showed that even like within a prison, they're outside looking in. And it also kind of looks like you're just outside the world. Yeah. Oh, thank you, Anne. Yeah. So, and I teach in prisons, and the energy really reminded me of what it was like to be in prison, but it also reminded me of what it's like to be an outsider, whether you're like watching a football game and you're not part of it, or you're watching other people live. One person said to me, like, I feel like life is a movie. Like, everybody else is like going to the park with their families and living and going to restaurants and going on vacations. And I'm not like them anymore. I'm not human like that anymore. So I hope the drawing to me kind of captured that spirit. And he's an amazing artist, and his name's in there. I can put it up. He sells t-shirts and things online too, but he donated it. Thank you.
Okay, Massachusetts Mike, you're up.
Hey, how you guys doing? Emily, great job. I'm from Massachusetts, and I'm going to email you outside of this. My situation is kind of a Romeo and Juliet situation from decades ago, and I currently have a lawsuit in regards to it. But I wanted to know, you said right off the bat that you will be writing another book. And I wondered, as an artist of your craft, if you know kind of where your brainstorm is going to go in regards to the structure of that.
I might have said book, but I meant study. I want to do a study right now on the prevalence of scams, because nobody knows how prevalent they are, because a lot of people don't report them. Like, I bet you can, you know, just I don't know if this was my class, I'd do a Zoom poll, but like, I bet a lot of people on here have gotten those scam calls, but most people don't report them. And if they are reported, there's no statistics on them. So I would like to know how prevalent they are, because it strikes me that that's also an invasion of the right to privacy, that this population is targeted in that way by people right. opposed to law enforcement, that the registry does this to them. And right. so maybe that's
a way. And they definitely do. I can tell you in the state of Rhode Island, they've done it to me a couple of times. So I've lived that experience.
I should, when I do these things, do like informal polls, because this is me talking to people. But yeah, thank you. So yeah, Rhode Island, I didn't.
Yeah. And then, you know, something that kind of the way that I work, and these things kind of come to me throughout the week, and I just research and I research. And, you know, this kind of isn't really on, well, it sort of is on this topic, but you know, I don't, everyone might know, you know, there's particular websites out there that are really big right now. And obviously one is called OnlyFans, where people upload stuff and people subscribe and whatever. And it is what it is. But it's interesting, because I read the Massachusetts law in regards to disseminating photos and storage and stuff like that. And apparently this was just ratified in Massachusetts literally just this year. But they're really cracking down on, they're probably going to bring a lot of criminal charges against a lot of these girls that have OnlyFans accounts. And so I don't know if other states are looking at this, but like, you know, if you have, you know, an individual and they have one of these websites and they upload stuff and people subscribe from all over the country, according to the Massachusetts General Law 272, Section 29, I have it in front of me right now, just having that data stored on your device can land you in a position where you could have, let's say, a 35-year-old female that doesn't think she's going to land herself on a sex offender registry, but she will, even though it didn't necessarily have anything to do with, you know, a minor or an interaction physically with someone else in their state or what have you. So it's almost like,
wait,
this
what?
Is evolving. Sorry, what?
You're telling me if an adult woman has an OnlyFans account, why is that illegal?
I think it depends on what state you're in, but in the state of Massachusetts, under Section 29, there's 29A and there's 29B, and those both pertain to minors, like photographing children, whatever. But Section 29, which is before that, is basically for everyone. So it's sort of like, say you're a teacher at a local school, and you are teaching an art class, and you have, you know, obviously nude photos for artistic purposes. That's actually not considered, you know, in the mix of the state statute. It has to be something that shows something lewd in behavior. There's a whole definition of the things that are lewd, that are outside of societal norms, is what the jury has to go by. So if your jury is, you know, a bunch of boomers from a different generation, they might think differently about, you know, a bunch of millennials and where their mind's at as far as technology goes. But in regards to Massachusetts, it says that if you take photos of yourself, you know, just of yourself, and you have them on that device, and then you are either selling those, or you're, you know, sending that out for profit, any sort of monetary gain, what have you, subscriptions, just like OnlyFans, the first offense is, I think it's a $25,000 fine and a minimum of 5 years in prison. If I'm reading this correctly,
and this is of adults,
third offense,
having pictures of an adult,
100% adults. It says whomever disseminates any matter which is obscene or knowing to be obscene, or who is in possession of any matter which is obscene, knowing to be obscene, with the intent to disseminate the same, shall be punished imprisonment in state prison. Oh, it says not more than 5 years in jail or house of corrections for the first offense.
And this is already passed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were I can see that they were just monkeying around with it just this year in 2023, in June. This is Massachusetts, obviously. So I don't know what other states are doing, but my sort of inner rogue lawyer that's untrained in law, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, you know, if you're a young lady and you've got this stuff, and it might not be on your device, it might be stored on a server in Nevada, right? So in that circumstance, how can state law say that? Would probably be obviously a defense strategy for anybody out there. But my point is like, I'm all about it. I think, like, you know, women have the right to their bodies, and you know, they have the right to do whatever they want. And I don't know. I just, it's mind blowing to me how the government tries to stick their fingernails in the system here. And
Do you not have like regular porn in Massachusetts? Like, is regular porn considered illegal in Massachusetts?
The thing is, I would assume that, yeah, well, yeah, I mean, you can access porn on the internet or whatever, right? But I think the difference is that the porn that you access is streaming, or it's coming from, you know, a server from a different state or whatever it might be. But you can't, as far as what I know, you can't like film porn in Massachusetts, right? Like, you can film porn in weird states. Like, I don't think you can film porn in Florida. I think you can film porn in like Las Vegas, but it's in certain counties, I think, is usually where these porn companies film. But that's, it's kind of getting outside of the scope. But what I'm sort of saying is, you have all of these girls that are in college right now, or if you will, that have these OnlyFans accounts, and these girls are pulling $10 a month times 3,000 members. You know, they're pulling $300-400K a month, and like, they're probably living high on the hog wherever they're living. But you know, it's just a matter of time before the government comes down on taxes, they come down on laws, they come down, and then you're going to see all these girls get put on registries, you know. So it might be something to look into, or at least something to think about, because we evolve, like this, the technology evolves, and so does these laws. And I think that's kind of how we sort of got into this mess, right? We're getting so far away from. So I didn't mean to go on a tangent, but
and people probably don't know this.
I don't think they.
You're not paying attention.
I didn't know it. I mean, now masses thing. There's a definition of like what is considered lewd, you know, and it's like anything. I mean, I guess in mass, if you send someone a dick pic, technically you're breaking the law or whatever, you know. I don't know.
Everybody, can we just be polite? We've got 45 more minutes. All right, CJ.
Hi.
Oh, hang on. Yeah, I'm mute. There we go. No.
Okay. Sorry. It might be me.
That was me. It was, I think you were clicking while I was clicking, and we were doing each other.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Hi, CJ.
That's okay. I appreciate you being here. My dad is the one who's on the registry, and he has a really screwed up scenario. There was an incident that happened when I was 8. Okay. I'm 50 now. So it's been a little bit ago. And he was accused, and it turned out this girl, she turned out to be 16, and so he served time in prison. His attorney told him at the time to plead guilty because they said, oh, you'll get a slap on the wrist, when in reality, he was drunk. His memory is spotty at best, so whatever. Anyway, he served 3 years. He's gone on with his life. My parents divorced during that time, remarried my stepmom. They've been together, you know, for 35 years, and they live in Missouri. Fast forward to 2009, he was pulled over by the cops, and they gave him a DUI. Well, they gave him a DUI. They ended up taking that away, but they said, oh, you've got a warrant for your arrest in Texas, which is where I am, which is where his initial, the offense happened in like 82 or whatever it was. And he's like, what? And he spent a year back in jail. They were trying to accuse him of running all of this time. And he had businesses in his name, cars, house. He wasn't running. And so it went, got into this whole convoluted thing of, them just trying to accuse him of running. And finally he got out of jail, but that was a year, another year of his life, from 09 to May of 09 to May of 2010. And that's when they said, oh, well, you need to be on the registry. He was never on the registry before. They tried to find his accuser, couldn't find her. And so their life has just shrank, like everything that y'all were talking about. You know, they used to go to church and they were involved, and they can't do any of that anymore. And it just is heartbreaking to me, because, you know, it just is. I mean, you understand. So that's just my story. That's my situation. That's why I'm here. And I appreciate you all being here. And thank you. I appreciate hearing about the book too. I'm definitely going to check into that.
Yeah, I can. I'll share my screen here if I can see this. Can you let me just, that's full screen. There you go. It's like a 20% off code, but you can also just get it from Amazon, which comes in a day. But anyway, if anybody would like, and my email is there if anybody wants to reach out. And I'm sorry.
Right, let's leave that up there long enough to somehow. Yeah, yeah. I can't even see it. My eyes are so bad. I have to do this.
I can make it. I can make it bigger. You know what? I will make it bigger. I have the original.
Thank you.
Yeah. Another question. I can.
All right. Well, CJ, you already had your hand up. So hang on. I got to figure out how to get back to my little list of who's reason. Laura M. You see, there's a Laura M.
Hi, Emily. It's Laura from California with Josh.
Oh, hi. Josh. I talk about you all the time.
Yeah. So,
I want to say something that I always say about you and Josh that I talk about all the time with people. When you told me Josh is very enthusiastic and helps and supports, and you said you have another child that is not as enthusiastic about engaging in advocacy because it's really hard.
Right.
And a lot of people really relate to that, that it's not fun. So one of the challenges that these organizations have is that a lot of people don't want to have these conversations and hear about all of the terrible parts about the registry, and they don't want to read a book about how it's really hard to find housing and employment. I often use you as an example. Like it's hard, and people.
It's a hard juggling act, especially to keep a family together, which I'm sure many of you know. So, and you lose family along the way. And just like you said, you didn't think you would, but a lot of people just turn their backs and, you know, don't want to deal with it. But hey, so as you know, Emily, my husband got out after serving 6.5 years in prison, and he's been out 7 weeks now. But the big thing after speaking to you and being interviewed that I didn't understand is that maybe a lot of you who have been incarcerated, what they tell the people in incarceration, because a lot of people don't want to be isolated or pointed, you know, have the scarlet letter on their back while they're inside. But the counselors and stuff know what you're in there for. And they all prepared my husband. Oh, no problem. When you get out, we're in California. They could put monitoring software on your laptop. You'll be given a laptop. You can work. You can do this. Well, reality hit the fan, and we're in Orange County, and the parole officer says, you absolutely cannot have a job on the laptop. You cannot, you know, with all that, you cannot. He had 3 jobs lined up, and he couldn't, the parole officer said, no, you can't do either. One was inputting grades back with Adams State. Again, a computer use, even though it was just to input the grades to be a correspondence for the incarcerated. So, and then the housing too. The housing, right now he's blessed. He's a disabled vet. So his housing and we are separate right now just because we don't want the pretentious neighborhood where I reside to go up in arms and then possibly be put back on the news and I lose my job and the whole thing like that. So we're kind of feeling it out. But another thing is that the parole officer, he had 3 in 5 weeks, actually, where the house he lives in, went to one of the other people of a registrant that had a job and actually went to the job and said in a very loud voice, does all these people know you're a pervert and that you're working here? And so I guess what I'm saying is that if you ever do write another book, you maybe on parole, you know, this might be good knowledge for you to separate it out, parole versus people that have gotten off of parole possibly, because I was just shocked, just very, very sad. And you're such an incredible writer, and thank you for all you do, Emily. So, yeah.
I just put the discount code to the book in there too.
In the chat. Ah, perfect. Yeah. All right, I'm going to take a quick second and screenshot that or something. I always have the problem. I always have the problem that once the chat is gone, then you have to rewatch. You have to wait till the thing uploads, and you got to rewatch it to even get to the chat. Because I'm always busy during the. So I'm going to.
And Emily, I'm just curious. Do you know if any politicians have bought the book or?
I don't think they bought it. I always like give them. To see. There was somebody who was very supportive who bought a few books and sent them to some politicians, but I I don't know if they've read them. I think for me, what I try to do is to be like as out there, so I'm quoted and I can say, here's what my book says. And then it's more like a politician will see that people have this perspective, you know, more than anybody reading a book, but they can say, well, she wrote this book, so she has some a leg to stand on. Like, look, I did all this research. It's published by Bloomsbury. This must be, you know, something meaningful.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. So I rushed someone off stage and now there's no hands. Greg, you have a hand? All right, go to it.
Let's see. Oh yeah, I'm unmuted. So you had brought forth the idea that we should partner with other groups. I think Anne said that, and that is that, is there benefit for us to narrow the distinction between those of us who are guilty of crimes, if they call them sex crimes, and those who are just guilty of crimes? I mean, there's criminals all over the place. I mean, one of the things that they made us do when we were in treatment is that we were not allowed explicitly to differentiate our crimes. I downloaded some porn of teenage girls. Some other person might have had, a 17, 19 kind of situation, sitting right next to a man who molested his own daughter. And we were not allowed to make distinctions about this, like, well, at least I didn't, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it leveled the field. We're all in this together. And is there benefit? Is it a doable thing to just make it that we're all just cons? We're all ex-cons. We all did time. We all broke a rule. We all committed a crime. And we're in there with drug dealers and flim-flam guys and armed robbers and, you know, ex-senators. I was friends with numerous ex-congressmen when I was in jail, at least where I was. So, is there benefit to that on the backside?
I think I know what you're asking, because I run a program for, I founded a program for people who are formerly, who've been incarcerated. And yeah. I say I founded it because when I started the program, the people who were supportive of this program said, well, you can only have nonviolent drug offenders. Now, there's basically no nonviolent drug offenders.
There are none of those. There's zero nonviolent drug offenders.
And they said, so finally, after negotiating back and forth, I was able to get the program approved. And I said, there's going to be no distinctions. I'll only run the program if you've been in prison and you want it, or no college degree, it's not some great scam to go to college. Like, if you went to prison for 20 years and you want to get a scholarship to college, why does it matter what you did? Like, it's not a get rich quick scheme. It's not some way to access people. But the only group that I was unable to assist were people on registries. And that's because there is a federal law about people on registries being on college campuses, people with sexual offense convictions. I didn't even know that. This is part of what I do sort of professionally. That gets... there's no laws about anybody else. If you have a violent offense, you can go to college. Only people, it's called the Clery Act. So there wasn't much I could do about that. But within the program, when we started this, now it's about 12 years ago, there was this thing about nonviolent drug offenders. And now I've seen there's so much grace and so much acceptance. And people, instead of saying felons and convicts, they'll say people who are incarcerated and people who committed an offense. And there's no differentiation. And even in New York State prisons, they're starting to encourage the corrections officers to not say convicts and felons and things like that. So I hope that at some point people on registries can be brought into this and have that same kind of acceptance as those who are not nonviolent drug offenders. I'm a criminologist. I've seen a huge, huge, massive shift in the way people who've been convicted of other crimes are treated and the programs and opportunities that they have. That said, one of the things that I think about is that there's a lot of people who run college programs. And now even Yale, Harvard, every college in the country brags about how generous and wonderful they are. They teach in prisons and they have programs for formerly incarcerated people. And nobody would dare say, oh, we only want to have people convicted of drug, nonviolent drug offenses. I think one thing that these programs can do, and I've been thinking about how to kind of do this with some other people working in this area, like take a pledge and say, like, anybody who's been convicted of any offense is eligible for programs that give scholarships to people who've been impacted by the criminal legal system, and say, like, we can't go around bragging how great we are, how we go and we serve people in prisons when we're like excluding some people. So that's like one way in, is have all the people that are getting all this credibility and getting grants and, you know, prizes, and you can go to any college, lots, I mean, not any, but tons of schools brag about their inside out programs, you know, a class on the inside, a class on the outside, and sort of shame these people and saying, you can't, you get all this money because you're not letting in one type of person who committed that offense. Same thing with housing and all of these programs. There's lots of housing movements that want to get rid of laws that restrict those with criminal convictions from living in certain public housing.
One other question. It does seem as though the whole sex crime thing is becoming a bailiwick of the conservative right and the extreme right wing, and I'm at a loss to figure out where they're going with this. Is it that it's no longer de rigueur to demonize drug offenders, and this is where the new drug offenders, the new drug dealers, you know how it was maybe 20, 30 years ago? I'm thinking about feature length movies about child trafficking, which is baloney. None of the research backs this up. There is not a worldwide child sex ring. It is not a thing. It is bogus. And yet people are making feature-length movies about this. People are watching it, thinking it's true, and repeat this. And is this a new thing? I mean, is this something that, and is this part of a overarching movement that our society is making? Or is this just an isolated situation?
I think these laws emerged from the feminist movement joining with the law and order tough on crime movement in the 70s. I think you're muted, but yeah, I think it kind of, these factors have been, this is what created the situation that we don't have allies on either side. The feminist movement, the carceral arm of the feminist movement, has created a whole apparatus of victims' rights advocates who approach this from a progressive Democrat kind of standpoint. And then you have those on the right who, yeah, think that there's like child sex trafficking rings and that people are groomers, and they're, you know, comes from like a pro-marriage, pro-family, religious kind of perspective. And also they believe very strongly in punishment in general on the right. So both of these things kind of come together. And like, I always get really mad because most of the people that are like mean to me are, because I'm in academia, whatever, are feminists who think that I don't care about victims, who think that I'm not, you know, supportive of women and children, and that, you know, the right doesn't bother with me, you know?
Yeah. All right, Anne, you're up.
Hi, Anne.
Hi, you know that I'm a big fan of yours, and you can't see us because we both have COVID and you don't want to see what we look like, so we're really sick. But I did buy many of your books, and I sent them to all my friends, and then I started sending them to politicians. I will never know whether they read them or not, and they don't answer my emails, so there's that. I still think we need a Ken Burns or somebody like him to do a film, a documentary, or even not a documentary, on, you know, life as someone who committed a sex offense, or what it really consists of, and how they're not monsters, and how, I mean, the whole idea of the fact that somebody did this thing, and of course they're going to do it again and again, and they're unstoppable, is the most frustrating part of this to me. And my son Nick is in for a very long time. I don't think we'll live long enough to see him, which I can't even say because it's so upsetting. And I'm determined, even though he signed a plea deal, to find a way. But we're in North Carolina, and I just want to say there are few or no courses or jobs in prisons. There's very, you know, the staff shortages, all of that, the same as all over the country. But when there is something like dog training or classes. Nick's not allowed to take any of that or do any of that because of his offense. And that's disgusting. That's utterly disgusting. So
yeah,
anyway, I think you're good, and I love that you're writing what you write. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. And I know the situation with your son is like beyond tragic and horrific. And I'm sorry, but it's amazing that you and your husband have like the spirit and energy to attend these things.
We do. Yeah. Thanks.
That's yeah. Yeah.
Just real quickly before I call on Abbasi, I noticed in the chats, people are like, oh, I'm in Virginia. You're in Virginia. Let's exchange information. I would love to find a way to do that with the broader group. I would love to have a list of people in Kansas that I could just say, hey, you know, I need something in Kansas, or hey, I need something in whatever. So I'll start thinking of a way to do that. I don't really know how to use a lot of our things yet. And I don't even know the answer to all those questions. Like, does Virginia have its own war? I don't know. I know some do and some don't. I haven't been completely briefed, but I'll try to figure that out. All right, Abbasi, you're up.
Okay. How's everybody? Is there echo? Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Okay.
It's my computer. Maybe I can't hear. I just came with an idea just popped into my head because we were talking about, collaborating with other organizations, reentry organizations. The only way we're not going to be thrown on the bus, I think we have to start our own. You have the war specifically for this particular population. I think like you guys, maybe in leadership, have to start a nonprofit. Maybe we all can pitch in like $10 just to get it off the ground, right? And just have a reentry that just don't discriminate. That's the only way you're going to make sure that you don't get thrown under the bus.
Well,
let's say you started a nonprofit organization, right? Reentry, so that way, you know, and you don't use any language that says like we're going to help people on the registry. You just say we're just going to help people that's, you know, been incarcerated, criminal justice involved, whatever language they use, right? But you just don't discriminate, and then you just go from there. That's the only way I think you can make sure that, because like I remember we mentioned Families Against Mandatory and these other type of organizations, and you were saying, and I don't know if it was you, but Miss Quote, but some people say no, they throw us under the bus or whatever. I think they mostly will. Once they get to the point when the senators and the politicians, the legislators rather, in the Congress, and they say, listen, we'll vote for this, but we can't have, we're not going to vote for a thing. Those other, they're going to say, well, no, they're going to go along with that and throw us under the bus. They're not going to. If we're in the room from the beginning, you said, like you be in the room from the beginning, help them out. I don't know if you can really trust them when it comes down to the thing and they say, listen, we need 3 more votes to pass this bill, but they're not going to do it unless you exclude so-called sex offenders. I can't see them not going along with that. Just remember in Florida, the voting. Okay, we're going to exclude the people for murder and the people for sex. I got one more thing to say, then I'll let you guys talk. Another thing is, other people, the groups, they don't really respect us unless we get more strength. They respect strength, right? So one of the things we can do, because I heard Mr. Horace was talking about the guy with helping him with the cover of the book, whatever, something helping her design the cover of the book or something like that. A lot of people here have different talents and different skills or whatever. Why don't we put something on a war site where people fill out a form? What do you know how to do? What is your, so we can start doing business with each other. 99.9% of the money, whether we're poor like me or you have money like some of the other people here, goes right out the window for people who hate us. We spend 99.9% of every dollar that we get with people that are unsympathetic toward us. If I could just buy a roll of toilet tissue or something from somebody who on like, in this movement, we can start that, like something like that. We have to keep at least some of our dollars with each other, and we have to build up some strength. Maybe I'm talking out of, do you guys understand what I'm saying?
Let's let Emily reply and see what she has to say.
I was just going to say, I definitely talk to people who would have fantasies, like I'm going to buy land and get a bunch of people on the registry, and we're going to have like a commune of some kind. And I also heard people saying things like, you know, maybe I'll start like a dating site just for people on the registry. But it comes from I understand where you're coming from. We should spend money. There's so many of us. But what I did definitely hear is that through these organizations, like I think the most important part of a lot of these organizations, you know, are the social networks, because you're so isolated. So people I talked to got jobs and help from people within other organizations and hired people. And there are a few small like businesses and others who kind of quietly help each other through the networks they build with these organizations. And I think that's really important. But I understand your bigger idea, but that's been lots of groups like Jews and African-Americans and others have said, let's spend money in our own communities since the outsiders won't help us. And it's a good strategy to some extent, but it's hard to implement in a diverse.
And we just simply can't do all the things well. The other thing we're talking about is picking one issue that you know, there's not a lot of movement on. We've got a couple of ideas for what that one issue might be, and then, you know, focusing our efforts there. But yeah, I mean, there's only so many hours in a day, and, you know, yeah, I wish it was easy. All right, I'm going to call on Maureen.
I was just going to say that I listened to I guess it was someone who had been previously convicted. I think it was a Narsal webinar that I was listening to. And the person that was there was talking about the fact that we have to make room for politicians to allow people on the registry to kind of be umbrellaed under other things, because if you approach it from, you know, head on, they're not going to be receptive. Some of them, when you talk one-on-one, are more willing to be an advocate, but they don't want to, you know, publicly come out and say, oh, you know, I don't think the registry, you know, we need the registry or whatever. So this guy was talking about, you know, crafting the bills for reform to where there's enough room to have it cover people on the registry. And it made a lot of sense to me because, you know, politicians are not going to feel like they're electable or popular if they take up the cause of reforming this ghastly, horrible, punitive, everything I could say horrible about the registry. But if we give them room to let it kind of piggyback on some other kind of criminal reform, then maybe there is a chance, because, you know, if we don't get laws changed, we can buy from each other and do this and do that. And it's absurd that we can't join forces with other groups like Narsal, War, you know, there's other places, and get a strategy that's going to work.
Well, the problem is we do actually have politicians who understand that it's costly, ineffective, and, you know, it's a civil rights disaster. We have politicians who are willing to say that privately to us,
right,
but they won't vote for it publicly because basically they've let this Pandora's box open. They've terrified for their own gain, right? To get elected, right, to run on like I'm tough on crime. They convinced everyone that, you know, our population is so terrifying and has the high recidivism and all this. And they can't box that back up. They don't know how to box it back up. So we have to do a bunch of things kind of all at once. We have to grow our army, and, you know, we need to get brave and start talking to more than just, you know, the guys that already love us. We need to find the people who are maybe, you know, a little convincible, and each of us needs to sort of grow our bubble a little bit. And, you know, because until there is popular support for these politicians who are willing to stick their necks out, they're not going to do it. I mean,
that's what this guy said.
Everything is so gerrymandered right now.
Figure out a way to where we can be umbrellaed without basically publicizing that this is going to somehow change the registry in a positive way. I mean, he made a whole lot of sense. I can't remember his name right now, but it's for that very reason that you're talking about. I mean, it's just not popular to come out and say, you know, right, this is a stupid law, it's harmful. And so anyway,
right. And what was popular for them, it was useful for politicians, you know, in the 90s, they got a lot of mileage out of it. And they, you know, there's I'll try to go find it. There's a graphic of all the billions of dollars spent on this system. You know, smallest one is commissary. And then, you know, there's the phone call systems, and then there's this, and there's, you know, lawyer fees and, you know, court fees. And it's, you know, it's outrageous amounts of money. And nobody wants to give that up. So the powers that be that are, you know, you guys are just all cogs in their machine. They're right. filling the beds. It's no longer socially acceptable to just sweep up all the people of color off of the street and put them in jail for, you know, smoking marijuana. You can't do that anymore. And so they have to come up with a new way to fill all these beds. And, you know, we're it right now.
Yep.
All right. Someone has a question for Emily Ann Smith. How do you see us getting a politician to stand up?
I mean, I don't think any politician is going to take a risk and advocate for us. I think we have to. That's why I really think we have to either work with other organizations and fight for criminal legal reform for all those with past convictions. I think as long as we're isolated, it's political suicide. If my opponent was going to do something for registrants, I know what I would do. I'd be like, look at that guy. He loves people who hurt kids. I love kids. I mean, it's the easiest thing.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So, but I do think when politicians have access to data and research about recidivism, they're going to be less likely to propose new laws, advocate for new laws, and more willing to not support absurd new laws, you know, and I think that's important. But I don't think anybody's going to stand up and abolish lawsuits.
And I think this, you know, there are big chunks of people. And if you look at all the people who've been affected by the political legal system, the criminal legal system, that's a lot of people. And those people maybe are a little more likely to, especially if we're helping them. And that's basically what we've been doing. You know, the Medicaid for all, Medicaid for people getting out of prison thing, you know, they needed votes, and, you know, they needed constituencies to go and, you know, talk to their legislators about. And we provided some of those. You know, we've provided people in some of their key states that they needed help with. And, you know, the hope is that, you know, they see that we're team players. We worked, we helped them. And eventually someday we, you know, if they don't throw us under.
Yeah.
Okay. It's hard to keep track of all these things. Eric Teal, is the registry tied to federal funding or for anything that is holding our actions and voices back? Eric, you want to just come on and say these words yourself? Where's Eric? Oh, no, that's just to me. Is the registry tied to federal funding for anything that is holding our actions and voices back? You sent that just to me, and I don't really understand it. So you sure I can't call on you, Eric?
Eric, maybe you can elaborate.
Yeah. So I was just curious on what, if anything, the registry is tied to as far as like funding that the state gets, anything of the sort.
I see.
That was my comment.
Yeah, I mean, well, most states make a lot of money from registry and related laws. And I think someone said earlier, you know, like, oh, are people on registries the new kind of boogeyman, the new drug offender, the new person convicted of a drug offense? Sorry. And I teach in a federal prison, and the corrections officers are always complaining that we're getting emptied out. The First Step Act is emptying this place out. We're going to have to lay people off. There's not enough people in here. And state prisons as well. I know in North Carolina, they've let out so many people convicted of drug offenses that they are worried about having to close some prisons at some point. And so sex offenses an area that is where convictions are growing, and there's not going to be any First Step Act that's going to help people with sex offenses. So certainly states have an interest in maintaining prison populations, in maintaining populations on supervision, and maintaining populations on the registry, because they are profitable. They make money, they can fund entire departments. There's federal and state monies that go to monitoring and surveying people on registries and people with sex offense convictions.
There we go. Massachusetts Mike says, if states are compliant, that's true. That is true.
Adam Walsh.
If states are compliant with the Adam Walsh Act, they get Edward Bryan grant funding to federal law enforcement agencies under the Omnibus Act of 1968.
Luckily, a lot of states aren't compliant.
Does anybody know the stats on how many states are compliant?
You can find it online, but Benny, do you know Joanne?
I see a Maureen Mahaney, or was this hand up from before? Maureen, do you have a new question?
No, sorry.
No, okay, it's from before. All right, well, I have, there's a Joanne, go to it.
I believe it's 18 states are substantially compliant. And I just heard that today on the NARSOL podcast, Registry Matters. But I have a question. You said that People on the registry are not allowed on college campuses under the Clery Act. And I just did some quick Googling. I mean, it looks like they have to report, they have to make it publicly available. I'm just concerned because my son, when he gets out of incarceration, would like to go to trade school.
Well, I would say many, many people on registries do report to security and are allowed to be on campuses as long as there's not like a daycare center. Here in New York, people on registries can go to our public universities as long as they don't go to like this pool and they don't do certain things. It's very challenging, but at the upcoming AXL conference, we're actually going to have a panel with people who, while on the registry, graduated from law school, graduated from college. One person on this panel got a PhD while on the registry, and I write about him in my book. So it's possible. It's just extraordinarily challenging. None of these restrictions. My issue is that schools get a lot of money when they say they're educating people who are formerly incarcerated. And they summarily exclude those on registries unless they go and do special things. And they're also not eligible for many of the scholarships. So, and also a lot of people don't want to go report to security. And a lot of, once you report, it's not as easy as it sounds, but you technically can be there if you go do that. But as a college professor, I can tell you, colleges don't like to have people on their campus that are going to be publicly listed on the website. Like,
sure. Because the public nature of the registry, you know, that's the same reason you mentioned this, you know, a dozen times in the book, probably way more than that. Just companies, you know, it's okay when nobody knows, but as soon as somebody knows, they're going to let you go. You know, maybe the HR guy knows, maybe the boss knows, but as soon as anybody else knows, they get scared because we're so radioactive. Our population is so radioactive. All right. After 2012, it's federally required for all states and tribal nations to be compliant or lose 10% grant. It's only Title I that's federally mandated. Other six title stars can choose. States can choose, I assume. Oh, good gravy. Okay. I don't know how to unmaximize my screen, so I have no idea what time it is. Okay, we got 9 minutes. I'm going to use 1 or 2 minutes to just say, while it was really hard to read, it was really... this is like all the best arguments that you ever hear, kind of all in one book, and then with a story for each one of them. So it's expensive, but I really feel like it was a really good read.
Thank you. Yeah, sorry about how expensive it is. When I wrote my last book, it was cheaper.
You don't get to decide that, I'm sure.
Yeah, they didn't consult me, but there's the 20% off and Kindle and libraries.
Yep, and then libraries. Libraries. Yeah. Yeah, I could talk with you for 2 more hours. I liked the section about how stranger danger, you know, they've convinced us that the scary people are the strangers, even though familial abuse is a way bigger chunk of the actual abuse. Got a great section on that one. I liked the part about Me Too backlogs persist and like rape kit, not testing rape kits persist. Not in spite of, but because of aggressive policing to regulate low-risk recidivators, you know, low-risk people. That was a really excellent, quote. Numerous people in the book said they would go back to prison for a few more years if it meant getting off the register, you know, not having to do registry when they get done. And then, you know, the number of people who said, you know, I took the plea deal because, you know, they promised me if I didn't plea out, they'd give me a really, really long sentence. So I thought I'd just take the plea deal. But of course, since no one who's not in the registry understands how terrible the registry is, you know, you think, yeah, okay, you know, 2 years and then you're on the registry, big deal. Well, you don't realize that the being on the registry is the bad part. You know, almost everybody I talked to says prison was, you know, I mean, it wasn't great. I didn't love it. But a lot of people say, you know, I kind of need a little prison time for this, or I need a little prison time for that. But it's the after prison part that's just literally killing us. There's another one in here about, sorry, I can't read with my glasses on and I can't read with my glasses off. It's terrible. There's a section in the conclusion about, you know, proof that people who do a sexual offense are considered worse than murder. You know, the fact that they're not allowed into nursing homes, that we'll let them freeze to death on the streets rather than let them into the idea that you know, some guy who's so decrepit that he needs 24-hour nursing care and he's in danger? I mean, it's just insanity. Absolute insanity. How many books need to be bought to be put on the bestseller list? I don't know. All right, we got five more minutes, I think. No more questions? You're really going to make me tap dance the whole time? I will. I don't really want to. People who are moving states because the rules are so hard to follow in one state. Oh, the number of people who had, I'm going to light myself on fire fantasies, or maybe I like go save a child as my last act and that'll somehow, they'll realize that I'm actually a good person. Oh, and then the other one, I really resonated with the part about several people mentioned how when they were in treatment programs, when you're in treatment, you're not allowed to give any mitigating factors. You're not allowed to mention that, you know, you were raised by wolves or that you were on, you know, meth or that you were, you know, when you're in treatment, no mitigating factors is considered good enough, that you have to just absolutely bow at the feet of, you know, the thing I did was the worst possible thing in the world. And you know, I did it willingly. And I really resonated with that because I remember when my partner was in treatment, just how just awful he would feel. He'd be all spun up for a day before treatment or therapy, for the day of therapy, day after therapy. It killed about 3 days in every week that he had to go. And the idea that this is somehow making us better, you know, when you know that the things you say in that therapy gets reported to your PO. There was another story where a guy knew he had underage familial abuse, which, you know, is what everybody thinks of as like the worst possible thing. He said he kind of knew it was coming. He felt it. He wanted help. He reached out to a therapist or something and asked for help, and the therapist denied him help. So, you know, we're spending all this time and money and energy managing this population that is not recidivating, that has an incredibly low recidivism. And when someone comes in and actually needs the help, we tell them they can't have it. Yeah, it's insane. Okay, 3 more minutes. Still no hands.
Well, I can just thank everyone, and my email is in the chat. And I know sometimes I don't always email back quickly, but I do read your emails, and I almost always email back quickly, especially if you have a quick or direct question. And Anne, I see your question in the chat. I do think it's really, really important for organizationally registry organizations to build formal links with other organizations in the history of social movements. That's how things move forward. And I think, you know, the other purpose of these organizations is to offer support and networks and companionship, because the one thing I learned most powerfully is that being on the registry is lonely, and these groups are really, really important for that. And it's not to be underestimated. I don't think the registry groups alone are going to, like, you know, march or do anything sort of in the civil rights model of social movements because of the particulars of this issue. If they want to do that, they have to work with other organizations, but they can provide support and information and ways for people to find housing and employment and be less lonely. And that's no small thing on a day-to-day basis.
I've been thinking lately about, like, a lot of people say they send letters, you know, that they'll look up people's addresses on registries and they'll send letters asking for people to join our groups and that they get no answer. Has anybody ever tried, like, going and knocking on a door and introducing yourself as a human being and trying to, like, you know, if each of us found a name in our neighborhood and we all know that there's, you could throw a stone any direction, find somebody. Have we ever considered, like, walking up to someone's door and introducing ourselves and we each make one friend, bring one friend into the movement? I don't know. It's very hard, very challenging. Anyway, I love you guys. I'm sorry that, I don't know.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you so much.
We love you. We all love you. Anybody that comes and does this work with no one in their family is like extra specially magical to us. You know, you're extra special magic, because this is a hard thing to do. It doesn't make you popular with anyone. All right. Love you guys. See you in 2 weeks.
Bye. Thanks.